All right, welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Today we're diving into a case, United States v. Drew, that I think you'll find pretty interesting. It all starts with a drug distribution charge, but then boom, a murder-for-hire plot is suddenly uncovered. Really goes to show, I think, how unpredictable the legal field can be sometimes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And for all you law students out there, this is more than just a fascinating story, right? We're going to break down some really important legal principles that came out of this case.
Definitely.
Specifically, things like conspiracy trials, how use of a firearm is defined in drug crimes. That's huge. And the rules about when statements made by co-conspirators are admissible as evidence.
Yeah, that's always a tricky
Oh,
one.
for sure. So basically, think of this deep dive as a close look at some major precedents in criminal procedure and evidence law, all stemming from, as you said, the specifics of United States v. Drew.
All right, so we've got all our materials in front of us, podcast guidance, a detailed brief of the case, and then just the standard brief of United States v. Drew.
Sounds good.
Our goal today is to really pull out the essential legal and practical lessons from this case, you know, the things that'll be most helpful for all of you. We want to give you a clear, solid understanding of the key rulings and why they matter, even today.
Definitely. I think that'll be really valuable for everyone listening.
All right, so to kick things off, let's set the stage. What happened? What were the basic facts of the case?
Okay, so it all began with Dennis Drew.
Okay.
He was indicted for cocaine distribution.
All right, so standard drug charge.
Right. Seems pretty straightforward at first. But things took a pretty wild turn when a government informant named Frank Biondo got involved.
Oh, wow. Okay, so an informant, this is where it starts getting interesting. What did he do?
Well, Biondo recorded some conversations with Dennis, and these recordings didn't just touch on the drug charges, they actually revealed a whole plot by Dennis to hire Biondo to murder someone.
No way to murder someone. Who?
Carolyn Tanner, she was a witness in front of the grand jury for the drug case.
Oh, wow. So talk about an escalation of charges, right?
Right, it went from drug distribution to a plan to obstruct justice through violence.
Yeah. And I'm guessing Dennis wasn't the only one caught up in these recordings.
You got it. The recordings also picked up conversations about drug trafficking that involved Dennis's brother, Earl Drew.
Oh, the brother. Okay.
Right. And also Hampton Stewart and Henry Tatum. So it's starting to look like a much larger criminal enterprise.
Wow. Okay, so we got multiple people involved, but the investigation didn't just rely on these recordings, did it? What else did they find?
No, you're right. There was more. Based on what Biondo told him, law enforcement got a search warrant and raided the place where these guys were living.
And what did they find?
They hit the jackpot. Drugs, firearms, cash, all found at the property. Gave them hard evidence to back up the charges.
Okay, so we've got the initial drug charges against Dennis, then this murder for hire plot targeting a witness, and to top it all off, physical evidence of ongoing drug trafficking with all these guys involved.
Yeah, it all adds up to quite a case.
Yeah, no kidding. So naturally, this led to some legal challenges. Let's unpack those, starting with the first one, severance. So for our listeners, what's the legal question here?
The question was whether the district court made a mistake by trying all four of the co-conspirators, so that's Dennis Drew, Earl Drew, Hampton Stewart, and Henry Tatum, all together in the same trial.
Okay, all together.
Right. Specifically, Earl Drew argued that he should have had a separate trial. He claimed being tried with the others hurt his defense.
Right, that makes sense. You can see why someone would want their own trial, especially when the charges are this serious and so connected. So, what did the Eighth Circuit say about this?
They were very clear on this one. They pretty much flat out said that co-conspirators being tried together is the standard practice. They even said, and this is a quote, "Rarely, if ever, will it be improper for co-conspirators to be tried together."
Rarely, if ever. That's pretty strong language. What's the reasoning there? Why is there such a strong preference for joint trials in these situations?
I think there are a couple of main reasons. First off, joint trials help avoid inconsistent verdicts. Think about it. If you tried each co-conspirator separately for essentially the same facts, you could end up with one jury saying guilty and another saying not guilty.
Yeah, that wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Exactly. It would kind of undermine the whole judicial process. And then joint trials are just way more efficient.
Right, I can imagine.
They streamline presenting evidence, reduce the burden on witnesses having to testify multiple times, and obviously save the court time and resources.
So it makes sense from a practical standpoint. Okay, let's move on to the second big legal issue in this case, the definition of use of a firearm under 18 USC section 924C.
Yeah, that one's big.
Yeah, Earl Drew was convicted on this charge, which carries some hefty penalties, right?
Absolutely.
What was his argument about the firearms?
Well, I think he was probably going for the argument that just having firearms at the place they shared wasn't enough to be considered use under the law. He probably argued that he never actually pulled out a firearm or pointed it or fired it during any drug deal.
So he's trying to say there's a difference between just having guns there and actively using them for drug trafficking. Did it work?
Not really. The court decided to go with a pretty broad interpretation of use under that section of the law. They stated, and this is another quote, "Mere presence and ready availability of a firearm at a drug house constitutes use."
Hold on, so mere presence and ready availability, that seems like it covers a lot more than actively using a weapon. So even if Earl didn't touch a gun during a drug deal, just having them there in a place where drug trafficking was going on was enough to get him convicted.
Exactly. The court put a lot of emphasis on the fact that Earl lived in the same house where the drugs, the cash, and the guns were found.
Okay.
And because he lived there, he had control over the place, right?
Right.
So the court considered those firearms to be ready and available for him to use.
To protect the drug trafficking.
Right, or to make it easier. The court didn't need proof that he was waving them around or firing them.
Wow, okay, that's a really significant point. It basically means that even if someone doesn't directly use a firearm in a drug deal, the mere fact that it's there and accessible can be enough for a conviction under this law.
Exactly. And for our listeners, you know, those of you going into criminal law, this is huge. Prosecutors don't need as much evidence now to get a conviction. You're going to see this charge used more often, even without someone actually pulling out a gun.
That's really important to be aware of. So defensively, what can be done?
Well, a good defense attorney might try to argue that the guns weren't actually readily available or that there's no clear link between a specific firearm and the drug operation, but it's an uphill battle.
For sure. Okay, let's shift gears to the third legal challenge, the admissibility of the taped statements made by the co-conspirators. Now, this gets into some pretty interesting evidence law, doesn't it?
It definitely does.
Yeah.
The issue was whether those recorded conversations with Dennis and the others could actually be used as evidence against Earl Drew. And this is where the whole concept of hearsay comes in.
Right, hearsay, which is generally not allowed in court, right?
Exactly. But, of course, there are exceptions, and the one that applies here is Federal Rule of Evidence 801-DOE. This rule deals specifically with statements made by people involved in a conspiracy, made during the conspiracy, and to help along.
Okay, so basically, this exception to the hearsay rule allows statements made by one person in a conspiracy to be used as evidence against the other members.
Right, but only if the statement was made while the conspiracy was going on and to further the goals of the conspiracy.
Okay, so it's pretty specific. So the big question here was whether those recorded conversations actually fit that criteria.
Exactly. But there's another layer to this, the constitutional side of things. You've got the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees someone accused of a crime the right to face and question the witnesses against them.
Right, the right to confront your accuser. So I'm guessing Earl argued that using those tapes against him, where he couldn't directly question the people who made the statements, violated his rights?
You got it. So the court had to balance the rules of evidence with the defendant's constitutional rights.
That's always a delicate balancing act. So what did they decide about using those taped statements?
They said the statements were admissible. They argued that the requirements of the evidence rule, specifically that the statements were made during and in furtherance of the conspiracy, line up perfectly with the confrontation clause. So basically, if a statement meets the requirements of this hearsay exception, then it's good to go. Using it doesn't violate the Sixth Amendment.
Okay, so they're saying if a statement passes the test for the co-conspirator exception, then the constitutional concerns about not being able to cross-examine the person who made the statement are taken care of. That simplifies things a bit, doesn't it?
Definitely, yeah. But it's important to remember those requirements. So for a statement to be used, it has to be made during and in furtherance of the conspiracy.
During and in furtherance of.
Yeah. And in furtherance means the statement was made to actually move the conspiracy forward, you know, not just casual talk or stuff said after the conspiracy's already fallen apart.
Gotcha. So it's not just any random chatter between conspirators. It has to be directly related to advancing their plan. That makes sense. All right. So we've talked about the three main legal issues in United States v. Drew and how the court ruled on each one. So now let's switch gears and talk about what this means for our listeners, the future lawyers out there, what are the key takeaways from this case that will be relevant to your future practice?
All right, so takeaway number one, this case gives you a much clearer picture of what use of a firearm means in drug crimes. And remember, we're talking about that specific law, Section 924C.
Right.
The key is that you don't need the person to actually be waving the gun around or shooting it. Just having the gun present and accessible in a place connected to drug trafficking and proving that the person had control over that gun can be enough for a conviction. This changes how these cases are investigated, charged, and defended.
Absolutely. It really broadens the scope of that law. And what's the second big takeaway our listeners should keep in mind?
The second takeaway is that this case reinforces how important it is to understand the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. That's Federal Rule of Evidence 801D2ME.
Right. We talked about that earlier.
Right. And especially its connection to the Confrontation Clause. You're going to run into situations all the time, especially in criminal law, where you have statements made by co-defendants. This case makes it clear that if those statements were made during and in furtherance of a conspiracy, they can probably be used as evidence.
Okay, so when you're evaluating evidence in a case with multiple defendants, remember that statements from alleged co-conspirators can be really powerful, but they have to fit those very specific criteria we talked about.
Exactly.
And finally, what about severance? What does this case tell us about the chances of getting a separate trial when you've got multiple defendants charged in a conspiracy?
This case shows just how hard it is to get severance in a co-conspirator trial. The courts really like joint trials in these cases. It's all about efficiency and avoiding those contradictory verdicts we talked about. Mm. Unless a defendant can show that they would be incredibly prejudiced by a joint trial, chances are they'll be tried with their co-conspirators.
Right. So the bar is very high for getting a separate trial. Mm. It's something to keep in mind as you're thinking about defense strategies in multi-defendant cases.
Definitely. Understanding that preference for joint trials is key to developing strong legal arguments.
Absolutely. So this case ties into some really important broader legal principles.
Oh, for sure.
United States v. Drew really highlights this core idea of conspiracy law, that when individuals get together and agree to commit a crime and then take steps towards that crime, they can be held responsible for what their co-conspirators do and say. It also shows how carefully the rules of evidence are designed. The hearsay rule, with its exceptions like the co-conspirator exception, is meant to allow reliable information into court, but also protect the defendant's right to a fair trial.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance to strike.
It really is.
And, you know, think about it. Imagine you're a young prosecutor just starting out, and you've got this key witness who's suddenly refusing to cooperate. This rule becomes your lifeline, allowing you to build your case using their earlier statements, the ones they made when the conspiracy was still active.
That's a great point.
And what's so fascinating about United States v. Drew is how it started as a fairly standard drug distribution case, but then it just opened up all these layers of legal complexity.
Hey, absolutely.
It touches on intent, the interpretation of specific legal language, the balance between evidence rules and constitutional rights. Just a lot to unpack.
Okay, so let's do a quick recap of the main points from this deep dive, especially for all the aspiring legal minds out there.
Sounds good.
First, the court in this case said that use of a firearm in drug offenses covers a lot more than we might initially think.
Right, it's not just about firing the weapon.
It's more about control and accessibility of the firearm in that context. Second, this case reaffirms that statements made by people involved in a conspiracy can be used as evidence against the others, but only if they meet certain specific criteria. And importantly, those criteria are in line with the constitutional right to confront your accuser. These are really important things to know as you move forward in your legal studies and eventually your careers.
Absolutely.
Now, before we wrap things up, I'd like to leave you with a question to think about. Based on what we've discussed and considering how much emphasis the courts place on efficiency with joint trials and this broad definition of firearm use, what kind of defense strategies might you use in future conspiracy or drug-related cases? It's not easy, is it?
It definitely isn't. And there's another layer to this. Think about the ethical questions that come up when statements made by co-conspirators, even private conversations, can be used against someone in court.
Yeah.
It really makes you think about the balance between effective prosecution and protecting individual rights. It's a fascinating and complex area of the law with very real consequences.
Mm, absolutely. And with that, we'll wrap up today's deep dive. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, everyone.